The Fearless Podcast, in a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. All right, y'all, welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. This is episode 51, and I have another incredible guest for y'all today. I want to introduce y'all to Trinity Vandenacre. Trinity is located in Montana. And so he's in Mountain Time, and we are dual streaming this from our channel and his channel. And I want our people to get a chance to, I want him to introduce himself, maybe give us, Trinity, maybe give us a little bit of your background and why did you even start this YouTube channel, and then what your channel focus is about?
Yeah. Well, how you doing today? I'm Trinity Vandenacre. I started in YouTube about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, or 2 years ago, actually. Before that, I was just, I guess I'll start back in why what I've done in my life that made me kind of have the idea for what I do now, which is promote ranching and the lifestyle that we have out here in Montana. And really, through this, discovered a lot of ways, or a lot of things that maybe need to be fixed, and problems that I saw in rural America that I didn't understand why they were happening. And now, because I've done this YouTube channel, kind of discovered some of the reasons why those are, and you well know those. I started in Helena, Montana, is where I kind of grew up, in the mountains up there, because my parents lost their farm up in Conrad, which is up near the Canada border. And my dad started a horse leasing company in the early 90s. So I grew up kind of with that. And then we moved out to a bigger area, and running a horse leasing company, helping my dad with that for 20 years, basically gave me a very wide view of agriculture and tourism, like how people view tourism, working with outfitters and then riding for ranchers all the time in between, and you know, packing back in the backcountry with horses and, for work, and all of those things, and dealing with actual people that were coming to Montana to see it, you know, coming to guest ranches, because that's what horse leasing is kind of you leasing horses to guest ranches and outfitters and kids camps and things like that. So seeing all aspects of it, really, and how they work together, how they actually work together, but how people don't see themselves as working together in those industries. And But I've always been kind of techie too. So I'm a cowboy that's techie, which has always been seen as kind of the weird guy over on, you know, over here to the side. And so I found a way with YouTube to actually put those things together. And I really just started messing around with video. And then I thought, well, if I really want to go with YouTube and do something with it, what is it that people care about? And all of the things that I do in the West with horses and cattle and the industry of ranching and all that kind of stuff, really, I think is something that a story that needs to be told to people, so they understand really why we do things out here. There's such a huge disconnect between the urban and the rural. People that live in the country and actually deal with the hardships and all this stuff that goes on with raising food and the lifestyle of that, disconnected from the people in the cities that go down to the grocery store and don't understand where that comes from. So as I started making videos about cowboy stuff and horses and things, I really discovered that disconnect is wider than I even thought. So that's where I'm focusing now, is more of my attention on, you know, interviewing people and bringing up issues like, this is how cattle get from out here in the West on pasture to your plate in the grocery store and through, you know, and what's the best way to do that? What's, you know, as far as environmental and ecosystems and, you know, I think we have such a long way to go to understand how cattle and meat can actually be beneficial, to where right now they're being sold to us as harmful to the environment and to us, right?
Yep. And what I think is even more beautiful about this topic is, as fractured as the social engineers have tried to fracturize this country, the one thing I think we can unite on as a people is the ability to sustain ourselves and eat food. And what's even larger than that is here I am. I'm in the South. I'm in Texas. You're all the way up there. So we're kind of from an American standpoint, I'm at one border, you're at the other border, but yet food connects us all. But then even this lifestyle of ranching, farming, growing food, growing cows, it really unifies all of us. Because if you're in a high rise and you want to eat a steak, it's still got to come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And there does appear to be a much larger conspiracy, for lack of a better word, for whatever reason, our food has been chosen as this thing that needs to be deconstructed and then reconstructed in a very unhealthy way, whether it's through a lot of this vegan propaganda. And we were largely plant-based, and I have nothing against vegans. There is an inordinate amount of propaganda out there that's being just jammed down our throats. But in reality, when you listen to people that do this stuff, and you know, we have a very small herd. We've been raising cows for about maybe 6 years now. And when you personally see, we bought a ranch that wasn't being utilized. And when I say ranch, you know, it's nothing like Texas or Montana. I mean, we have cows on 25 acres. We have a total of about 50 acres. And that's not even a ranchette. Like, you're a joke. That's a mud puddle. You know, I get all that. But I mean, there's incredible power in raising cows, and you can watch the net positive benefit on the land to the point where I can say, not only is it the solution for my food source and my community, but I'm going to say that it's a necessary requirement if we do care about the environment and we do want to improve the environment. And, you know, a lot of this climate change stuff is just a psychological operation, and it's has a lot to do with the technocracy and all these other things that aren't science-based. It's more like scientism and the worship of science as a god, science falsely so-called. But when you're active in this process and you're raising these animals and you're interacting with them, and then you're producing this very healthy food, you know what it's eaten, you know how it was processed. These are the solutions to the problems that we're facing as a country. And a lot of people want to dismiss it, and they'll say very dismissive things like, oh, so you're going to, if we don't have these gigantic CAFOs or these giant farms, how are we going to feed 8 billion people? And that's a very stupid way to dismiss the problem and leave it to the technocrats and the oligarchs and the legislature and the district of criminals, as I like to call them, because there is a collaboration of transnational corporations and our ruling class to deconstruct our food system and to starve us all out. I don't know. When you look at what they're doing and how they intentionally do it, I love the fact that you've been bringing attention to the way that our different meat sources have been fully and completely integrated from top to bottom, and then systematically absorbed by the JBSs and the Tysons. And, you know, we're in cattle country and we're in chicken country. Tyson and Sanderson have a lot of chicken houses out here. If you drive 5 miles in any direction, you will, where I am, you'll pass thousands of cattle, thousands of head of cattle. And what's fascinating to me is you can drive right to our local Walmart, which is 7 miles from here, and you can buy a steak, and there's a really good chance that it came from China or somewhere in South America. And if that doesn't show you how incredibly broken and manipulated our food system is, and how we're all being played out. And if there was less government collusion and less regulation, for lack of a better term, our local ranchers would be able to live in, one, a sustainable way, two, in a profitable way, and three, that cow that I drove by 6 months ago out in that pasture, well, I just purchased it at my local butcher shop or at my local grocery store, right? When the reality is there's a really good chance, instead of buying the cow that was 3 miles away, I bought the cow that came from overseas that might've been processed a year ago or whatever. It kind of just speaks to this whole problem. We see these supply chain issues. And so the attention that I want to draw to people is, like, at one point in time, there were thousands of microprocessors in America, and now there is a handful. And we use a very small local processor here, Titus County Meat Processors. And this building is so small, I don't even know how they do it. It's just incredible to watch this process. It's family owned. We drive there, we drop off our cow. They butcher it, they hang it for a couple weeks, and we pick it up. There aren't multi-steps. There isn't all of this waste. And we know the family. We can see the facility where it's processed. We know the cow. We know its history. And these are where all the issues happen. You know, with, they create these scares about now. Well, the new scare is like bird flu in cows. And
you bring up a lot of issues here with the, so when you're talking about government regulation and the problem with the beef system, one of the things, two sides to this coin is, one, some people think that it's government that is the problem, and other people think it's, and maybe deregulation, and some people think that it's needs to be, you know, the, it's the corporate mindset that's the problem. So it can be both of these things at the same time. I think it's actually a complication of three things. Number one, the focus on climate change right now in business, so that businesses want to, are for some reason, my son calls it the Thanos idealism. It's like, so Thanos is a character in a Marvel movie. He's the bad guy, and he wants to destroy half of the people in the universe to save the universe. So there's a mindset that we have too many people. We need to limit those. We need to stop utilizing our grazing areas for cattle, because that's bad for the environment. Did I just freeze up?
You froze up, but your audio is good.
Oh, okay. So there's that argument, but then when you look at like deregulation, and government is, I believe government is not there to regulate everybody and tell them exactly what they need to do. I believe they're there to create an environment where people and businesses can thrive. And those are two different things. So if the problem right now is we have four companies controlling all of the beef industry, right? So you have 700,000, over 700,000 ranchers or beef producers, but only four companies they can technically sell to. So when we're talking about like selling direct from rancher to customer, which is not going to be a viable argument for every single person, right? There has to be a way for these industries to operate, and you should be able to sell directly to customer. I'm not saying that. I think that's probably the best way that you can get your beef and know where it comes from. Absolutely. But we also need to break up the four companies. And that, I think that the only way to do that, one of the quickest ways to do that is to just implement the law that we already have against monopolies and the anti-stockyards, you know, the Packers and Stockyards Act, which means they're not supposed to be able to control that much, 85% of the market. You know, so there's so many issues to this.
What's fascinating is that exact same issue is the technology issue we have with these technological monopolies that are creating all these problems with free speech. And it's the exact same scenario. There are laws on the books to prevent this stuff, but they're not enforced.
They're not enforced. Yes. And
oh, Trinity, I lost your audio. So while Trinity might have to cycle his camera and audio. There you are. You're back.
Am I back? Oh, yep. I'm not in the camera though.
Yeah, your camera's still down, but your audio is back.
Oh man, I apologize.
That's okay. I suffer with these tech demons too. Like it's always a challenge.
How would I get this back?
If you maybe unplug and plug back in your camera and it should pick it back up. Yes. Andy said it's called regulatory capture, and that's what we are being manipulated and exposed to. And it would be great if there were real statesmen that had their constituency in mind and heart and represented us.
That's where the other side comes in, which is money.
Yep.
Because so we're dealing with companies that are billions and billions of dollars. So last year, 2023, Tyson, which is one of the big four packers, and they control most of the chicken and pork industry, plus a huge margin in the beef industry. So on paper, last year they lost $630 some million, according to them. But their executives, their top executives, got paid bonuses of over $32 million. So there's no way you actually lose $630 million if you're paying yourself $30 million, right?
Right.
So, yeah. I mean, it just doesn't happen. So they're just operating that way because the year before, 2021 and 22, during COVID, they took over they just like socked it to the retailer as well and ended up making like a $1.4 billion net profit, which is astounding. You know, they couldn't even. So anyway, that whole thing. So you got the aspects of the government, but you also have the aspects of money. They have billions of dollars then to go lobby at the government and pay people to speak on their behalf. And the little guys, you know, the 700,000 ranchers are spread out and they would just want to do their job of raising cattle. You know, they just want to be husbands.
Yeah. And the easiest way to resolve this representation issue is term limits. You know, if we would finally, because then you wouldn't have these long term NASCAR drivers. You know, every Congress critter, you know, they're so subsidized by big this, big that, big pharma, big ag, and they're so manipulated by it. Right. And then they cycle in and out. There you are. You're back. So they cycle in and out of Congress, and when they're not in Congress, they're the CEO of Monsanto, or they
turn into a lobbyist
or a lobbyist, yeah. Right? And it's this good old boys club, and they stay. So there's very simple, not easy, but there are very simple ways to fix the problem. And the beauty of being a rancher, and this is why. The beauty and the simplicity of the concept of just buying direct. We scalability wise and 8 billion people, we totally realize that everybody can't do that. But there are millions of people that can that aren't.
Mm-hmm.
That's another part of this conversation is, hey, how about everybody that can, how about we do that first? Because then once we can say on our own in a parallel sense, create these solutions and then show them as viable. I was privately, when we were talking, I was talking to you about the Beef Initiative, and what Texas Slim and the Beef Initiative are doing is they are connecting ranchers and consumers for direct purchase. And then they're also connecting them with microprocessors. And there's been several ranchers that have started their own microprocessing. And in a large way, it's a lot like the one man, I forget his name right now, that you interviewed. He used to be a feedlot.
Calicrate. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Calicrate. Yeah. And I mean, what he has done is so exceptional, and he's been able to kind of synergize his operation and then expand it. So it's scaling as far as what he's able to provide, and you're creating jobs all at the same time.
Well, here's the thing about what he did is, what we're talking about is, one of the things that keeps coming up when we're talking about this is, going direct to the customer is definitely a great way to go. Like you say, it's the way that a lot of people should go. But you have this thing where at some point you have to decide to do the extra effort to do that. And that's where we're having a struggle. It's like, even when I was talking to Calicrate, now Mike Calicrate is a guy who used to be a feedlot owner and provide and feed beef for one of the big packers. And when I say one of the big packers, is because there's four of them, but they actually decided to collaborate and divvy up territory. So they would never actually buy. There was no competition between the four of them. Even they would just divvy up territory and say, okay, you're going to buy cattle over here, you're going to buy cattle over here, you're going to buy cattle in this area. That way they wouldn't have to spend as much.
Yeah.
They would have to, all they would have to do is, offer you what you had to take, whatever they could give you, whatever they decided to give you, because nobody else was going to give you another offer, because they had there's no competition there. Right. So he started, once he got out of that and lost tons of money, he started raising his own cattle, feeding them in his feedlot, then butchering them in his own butcher facility that he ended up building, and then creating two stores in Colorado Springs where he sells his meat and all the byproducts of the meat, which is all healthy stuff, bone broth. And it's incredible what he's done with that place. Yes. And he wants people to replicate that. But during that process, a friend of his that was a businessman said, okay, we got to this point. Now let's make this process more efficient. So let's get this stuff here cheaper. Let's get the labor cheaper by offshoring some of the labor. That is where, even with the best intentions, you end up losing most of these operations, because if you're trying to go for efficiency only, you end up messing up the process of, so you have to have almost a person that has ideological goals of like, I'm going to do this because it's going to bring in income to our community, and I'm not going to buy from Sysco for my restaurant. I'm going to buy from local ranch. I'm not going to, even though Sysco can undercut everybody with price because they own 100% of the market.
Yeah, and it's because nobody wants to analyze they understand the cost of everything and the value of nothing. And they don't want to, this is what is so harmful about buying at Walmart, is because you're taking your local economy. You want to know how urban America has been eviscerated. There used to be all these small, beautiful, small towns, right? And you had your local store and all these different things. Well, when you take your dollars and you buy something at Walmart, you literally redistribute your wealth largely to China, but everywhere but here. And when I say here, I mean everywhere but America.
Right. Right.
And that's where we have to start, one, as consumers, and two, as Americans, and three, as human beings that want to continue to like eat healthy food and breathe clean air and all these things. We have to start realizing there is a cost, there's an additional cost, but the value is exponentially greater than the cost. And while it is, okay, I'll give the example of buying from a rancher. So say you buy a quarter, a half, or a whole. There's a lot of moving parts to that because, I mean, to buy a whole cow, when you're buying 300 to 500 pounds at a time, you have to have freezer space. You have to have the ability to transport all these different things. So there's some inconvenient things about that. But when you look at the quality of what you're getting and then its impact on your health, there's a much smaller price that you're paying holistically, and you are retaining your dollars within your local community, which is going to bolster and make your local community thrive. I think a great example of this is Will Harris down in Bluffton, Georgia, and what he's done with his cattle operation and the amount of jobs that he's created and what he's done to that sleepy little town. I think it's a perfect illustration of keeping your money in your community, creating jobs that pay a living wage, and, you know, just the intrinsic value. Oh yeah, but that beef costs $11 a pound. But what about the jobs? And what about that $11 is staying in your community? Like, you could buy beef at $5 a pound, and if it gets injected straight to China, like, it's gone. There's no multiplication factor there. If you spend your dollar locally and it creates a job, and then in turn, that family buys a house in your community, and then they spend their money, and that dollar exponentially expands, maybe by a factor of five. If you go to Walmart and buy your stuff, you are taking your money and shipping it to China.
That's so true. When we look at these things, you look at people like Bezos, because we're talking about Amazon, and the Waltons, which own Walmart. What used to happen is all that money, that the reason they're so extremely wealthy, and they make, you know, like Walmart's profit was over $500 billion last year. They have we just start thinking in billions of dollars now because we've seen so much of it, but it's $1 billion. If you spent $1,000 a day for 2,000 years, you would still not run out of money with zero interest. That's $1 billion. So when you make $500 billion in 1 year, you don't even have enough places to spend. I'm not saying that it's bad for somebody to make money. What I'm saying is this money used to go into communities because people would bring things to local shops in a community. And then when you bought from them, all the profit from those products would go to that local community, and they would then hire people in that community. They would actually put money towards schools. They'd pay more taxes in those communities. They would, they're involved in those communities. They say that the dollar turns over seven times in a local community. But what we've done in this name of bringing down prices for consumers, which I understand, one of the ways that we've produced, so it's kind of a two-edged sword. We've produced a way for people to live on less because they can buy really cheap food, really cheap products, super cheap, because we've outsourced everything. So now that we've outsourced everything, those small communities are starting to die, though, because the money that used to go into them and then go out of them into the ecosystem, and, you know, we'll talk about that in just a second, like the ecosystem and how money in a community actually helps an ecosystem. But now all the dollars go away from the community immediately. The products are brought in from somewhere else. So you have two jobs or three jobs instead of 50, right? The money doesn't go into the local schools. It doesn't go into the local economy. It goes to Bezos, which is why he's the richest man in the world. I mean, that's where all the money from our local communities has gone. Same thing with the beef industry. They have just created a way to now they siphon off all the money to them. So the profit used to be every dollar that was spent on beef, 68% of it went to the producer, which is actually has to be split between the feedlot, the backgrounder, and the person who raises the beef initially and sells the weanling. So all of that was 68% and 68 cents on every dollar. And then above that went to the packer and the retailer. Now it's reversed, and it's like 35 cents goes to all those people down there below. And if we're looking at this, you look at a chart that shows the profit of, you know, the producers, which are the background or the rancher and the feedlot, and then the retail and the packers. And the packers margin is actually pretty slim in that. You know, it's pretty narrow. You got this pretty large margin at the bottom, 35 cents, right? And then you got a larger margin at the top for retail, because now they have so much power, they can kind of dictate the price. And you go, what's going on there? Well, the packer doesn't take the risk. The packer is the one who buys the finished animal, so it's ready to butcher and sell directly to the retailer. They hold it. Their turnaround is 7 days. So they're making billions of dollars, and they know if they can control the market, which they can right now because they have so much power, they know what they're going to buy that for. They know what they're going to sell it for. And in 7 days, not a whole lot of that is going to change.
Right.
Right. In the, below that, the from the time the calf is born to the time it's sold to the packer is 2.5 years. So you can't figure on anything in 2.5 years if you're not selling it yourself. From the time it's born, you're like, oh, the price of beef is really good, or the price that the packers are giving us is really good. And by the time you sell the weanling, it's half of that because they've dropped the price, and right now it's high. So you're like, great, now the ranchers are making good money, except for all their interest rates are double. So now they're paying double the input costs on almost everything that they did. And what that price does to me is it makes all the small guys that are starting out, like you're talking about, the small packers, it hurts them, because now the ranchers who don't have connection with that, they're now selling directly back to the packers. You're like, well, the price is high. And the little guy who's trying to start something has to outbid a $1 billion company to get started. And that's just not going to happen.
Yeah. It's how they can. And then what happens is prices are high here. Then the packers and the cabal, the beef cabal, they'll flood the market with meat to push the price back down. So what they'll do is, like guys like me that has to buy a 1 or a 2 year old at like $1,700 to $2,200, right? I'll make those purchases, and then they'll flood our market with beef, drive those cow prices back down. Well, now I have a minimal cost basis of $2,200, that even if beef prices tank, like, how do I can't make up for that.
Right.
You know, my cost basis is still there. And then speaking to your point, you made a great point about how they've made the cost of living, so to speak, they made goods incredibly cheap, and mm-hmm. they had to do that by design because they've been printing money like drunken sailors, right? So the only way that they could maintain this American lifestyle, you know, this hyper consumerist lifestyle where you have a big screen TV in every room, right? Is, well, instead of that big screen TV costing $4,000 like it should, you can buy it for $3,000, $300 at Walmart, because they ordered a barge from China, you know. And this has been part of this long game of devaluing the dollar and extracting it from America. And you can read Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, and that talks about Henry Kissinger and Bezinya Brzezinski and, you know, the China Project. Like, they started this like in the 60s and 70s, and they just love communism so much, and it was such a great model that, like, hey, we're going to make China this production giant. We're going to export everything. We're going to export the jobs, the manufacturing, and then we're going to make them the main supplier. And this is the definition of the redistribution of wealth. And then we're going to say that China is like this hybrid capital, you know, it's this hybrid capitalistic model, you know. It was so funny because I was a financial planner for 11 years, and I worked for a pretty big firm, and we had a fund manager come in, and he was touting these emerging market funds, and the funds he was promoting were China funds. And he said this out loud. He said, you know what's great about every single company in this portfolio? It's owned and backed by the government, so it can't fail. And I'm looking around this room, with guys that were like, I was wet behind the ears. I'm like 23 years old and I got all these 60 and 70 year old guys that have been doing this. And I'm like, does anybody hear what he's saying? Like, and I had just gotten out of college and I'm like, this is communist propaganda, man. And nobody liked me because I said that, but but you know, this has been a really long game. And now this is why the information is that much more important, because this has been a very long strategy and a very long game, and they've taken all the money and now they're trying to take the rest. They're trying to take the real estate. You know, you have guys like Bill Gates, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street. They're sucking up residential. They're sucking up ranching and agriculture because they're trying to extract every last drop. And that's why you crush and break the rancher, right? So eventually he has to, we just did a podcast maybe a couple ago where we were reading a local article about local ranchers in Longview and the surrounding area selling out just because they're too old to manage and their kids aren't interested and they don't want to sell the property, but they just are, you know, and that is this long game. And the problem is when those guys sell out, nobody's going to be growing those cows again. And that land isn't even going to be used for that. And this is where environmentalism comes in. The best thing, and I realize this is antithetical to all the technocrats and the vegans and what everybody's saying, the best thing for this planet is for those cows to chew that grass. They're going to eat that thing that nothing else can eat. It's going to convert it into a highly nutrient-dense food source with these essential fats that every brain needs, you know, regardless of whatever the vegans think, their brain needs that fat. And if they don't eat it, there will be consequences. And I think we're seeing that too. But this is not only a necessity for us to continue to survive as a species. This is a necessity if we want to breathe clean air and we want topsoil that'll actually grow anything. And that goes for your lettuce and all the great kale and asparagus and broccoli that the vegetarians like to eat. They need that cow just as much as we need that cow.
Right. Well, all of this is so, when I started into it, I thought there's got to be a simple everything to this. You know, I thought it was pretty simple, but it's fairly complicated. I mean, you got China involved here, but we're also dealing with, you know, with the meat packers, we're dealing with Brazil, you know, so half of the companies you buy in the store from meat from are Brazilian owned, which is, so you're shipping money over to Brazil. And then this idea, the second idea that you're talking about is this idea of saving the planet through eliminating cattle. Basically, you're eliminating meat eating. So you're trying to eliminate cattle and you're saying that that's better for the environment. And that is deception in my mind. That's very bad deception, because one of the things we have to remember is that there was buffalo all over the West covering this whole country. And so right now what we're having, and this is, I guess, my weird way of starting into a conversation about climate and what you can argue all you want about carbon and CO2 and everything, but cows actually can help sequester CO2 in the soils, just like buffalo did in the past. And we're seeing lots of places turn into deserts and because we're not grazing cattle on our land, because we have this idea that we're being sold this idea over and over and over again, that it's got to be vegetables that we eat and that we need to keep the price of everything down so far. Well, the only way you can do that, to keep the price of everything down so far and then eat vegetables, you know, farm goods, is to buy things from other countries that we don't agree with and rape the land with farming. Because when you're farming, immediately when you plow up any ground, you lose all the carbon sequestration out of that soil. It's like 90% of it leaves the minute you plow it. So I'm not saying farming is bad either. I'm saying our farming practices of today are bad. They're very, very bad. So you're going from something that can be a massive benefit and actually has to happen, which is grazing all over. Grazing and learning how to graze like nature used to graze. You know, you see study after study after study of when you move your cattle around the way the buffalo used to move around, which is not, it doesn't look good. It looks good after you do it. But when you watch this, and what I'm talking about is intensive grazing practices. I'm going up to a ranch actually tomorrow to do a video on this, about you're moving your cattle around and you're basically hammering that ground. So when you leave it, it looks like it's messed up. I mean, it looks like you just destroyed the ecosystem. And in fact, that's what buffalo did. They ran in herds of 100,000 buffaloes. Some people talk about, you know, when they would see a herd of buffalo go by for 3 days, 3 days streaming by them and never see the end of it. I mean, that's how many buffalo, when they were condensed like that, they weren't just like grazing a pasture like cattle were. They were destroying the ground, what it looked like destroying it. And what we're finding is scientifically that was actually benefiting the land in enormous ways. It was helping the plants grow better because they would hammer it like that. Then the land would rest and it would actually regrow better than it was before. Where I'm going tomorrow, they're showing increases of 500% in plant growth with no additional water. That means that with using cattle, you're producing something for humans to eat, you're actually saving what you say that we want to save by taking the cattle off, which is completely opposite.
This is what's fascinating about the argument, is because we can clearly demonstrate, and guys like Joel Salatin, guys like Will Harris, Gabe Brown, they have scientifically proven this with the data, with the soil samples. And logically, you would think this intensive grazing thing, like, yeah, this is bad. If the cows were left to their own devices, just in a pasture, they would not naturally do this.
Right.
But the beauty and the science of it, of the creation of the way God created man and animal, and when they interact, it produces abundance. In and of themselves, man by himself, animal by himself, they will still produce and it will be serviceable. But when they interact and work together, abundance. And it's cleaner, it's fresher. They don't have to worry about soil health. You don't need dewormers and all these chemicals. And that's the answer. That's the solution. And one, that requires people to be educated. And two, the technocrats have to get out of the way and let it happen.
Yeah. And there's the mindset that we can't, that the right way is always that something doesn't have to die. We have to get rid of that mindset because, and you know, 100 years ago or something like that, this mindset couldn't really prevail. You understood because you had to see things die for you to eat. It doesn't matter whether you have vegetables or whether you grow wheat. Things have to die for that to happen. We have to kill a cow to have a steak. Yeah. I was just watching. I don't know if you've seen Clarkson's Farm
on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. And one of the most recent episodes, he was raising pigs. And this is a guy that is not familiar with farming at all until the last 3 years he's done this show. And my daughter and I both cried watching the baby pigs not make it, you know. And yet he goes to the farm shop where he's butchered pigs and is going to sell the meat. And he's like, this is the disconnect, that this is the connection that people miss, is that farmers do everything in their power to keep the health and the growth of their animals up. That we spend so much, we care for those animals. But we also understand that at the end, they are our food. And I think one of the one of the things that connects us back to that is understanding that humans are part of the ecosystem. They are important to the ecosystem. And right now it's like this, humans are always, are the problem with the ecosystem in ways they are. Let's take, for instance, this idea in trying to bring down the food cost for people, we have put retailers and the packers in complete control of our beef or meat food supply, right? And that is supposed to be better efficiency because these global climate change people, these companies are now touting that as we have to have these big companies to create climate change. And yet when I'm down videoing this thing, I'm watching cows that are out in the field and then go into a feedlot that is built for 14,000 and it has 1,200 cows in it. They have so much room. There's like, these cows don't really ever have a stressful time, right? They go from the pasture to a feedlot and then in a kill plant and they're right on your plate. Stress is bad for animals, okay? Then leaving there, I flew over a feedlot that's owned by one of the packers and it has 170,000 cattle in it in one shot, one place. One set of pens. It's just a black mass down there below us. If we think that is better that for the insane animal or better for the environment in any way, you're condensing all of the manure, all of the urine, everything into one spot for 170,000 head of animals. Where you can't even utilize that. Where are you going to put it? If you spread all these out and you have 1,000 feedlots with 1,000 animals each, right? They use that, they can use that manure. They can use all the byproduct from the butchering to spread as fertilizer. So we don't have to use this anhydrous ammonia stuff that we're killing our soil with. And so you have natural fertilizer. You have the ability to graze them on a pasture and actually utilize the benefits of intensive grazing. And instead we have created a model in the name of climate change. This is why I call it the Thanos philosophy. In the name of climate change, we're killing what we're trying to protect, because now you have hogs all raised indoors by the thousand, and then you have to feed them antibiotics forever, and you have to make a breed that doesn't have any fat in it, because the fat is actually what traps all, so all the antibiotics you put into an animal are stored in the fat and never leave. So then they've bred down these hogs to no fat, so that you don't have that in the animal. They never leave the indoor facility, and they're butchered. And you go out and see hogs that are raised outdoors. They don't look anything like, they're happy. They're rolling around in the mud. They're curious. They run up to you. And, you know, it's amazing to watch hogs be in outdoors where they're supposed to be. And then we think we're going to save the environment by putting all of them in a building, which is the same problem. Not only is it horrible for the animals and the chickens and everything, but then you're condensing all of your waste into one spot where that you have to distribute then.
So yeah, and so, you're creating these bird flu crossovers when these animals are packed hip to hip and can't even move or breathe their own air.
Well, and then so you talk about the bird flu thing, and so let's say people are like, well, we need one company because then it's easier to monitor for safety and everything. Okay, but as soon as an E. coli thing happens, which happened like a couple weeks ago, and the company that sent out the burger, you go to the grocery store and you see 15 different labels. If you search what Cargill labors, how many companies Cargill owns, all of those are Cargill. So you're looking at a whole bunch of logos and labels and everything. They're all the same company. It's the same exact burger that comes from the same exact factory. It's not any different. So there's most of the burger stuff comes from Brazil because it's cheaper. So you ship this in and it's just distributed. They have this E. coli thing like a couple weeks ago. They don't know where it went. They said it went out nationwide. Because, of course, if you have one company distributing it through 20 different brands, it goes everywhere. So if you have a problem with any kind of a safety thing like bird flu or E. coli or anything in the meat, it's already gone to everywhere in the United States. Whereas if you have 1,000 small plants and you have something happen in one of them, guess what? It's pretty easy to track that because you know who they sell to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this brand or this particular thing went out to these stores. Now I know where the problem is. There's no way to even track it with the, so in the name of what we're trying to save, my point is in the name of trying to save these things, make them more efficient and safe, we're actually making them way harder and less safe.
And what's amazing is in permaculture, there's a rule and it says the problem is the solution. When it comes to technocratic transnational corporations and this monolithic capture, their solution is the problem. It's literally inverted. And that's why decentralized, the solution is, first point, decentralize. We need to decentralize. There needs to be less consolidation. There needs to be more ubiquity, which would naturally work because cows need grass. They can't live hip to hip eating corn.
Well, they can, but you have to give them a whole bunch of medicine to be able to do it. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you have to be wise enough in your consumption to say that cow that's being raised on corn and antibiotics, I might not die the night I eat it. I might die in the first decade, but 15 years from now, I might have three different kinds of cancer. And it probably came from that China burger that had 1,000 different kinds of DNA in it. That was fascinating. When I heard about the burger processing, they tested it and it had 1,000 strands of DNA in one burger.
Yeah. That's hard
to even fathom.
It is. And that's why you're ending up with like an E. coli problem everywhere, because if one cow had it, had a problem, it goes nationwide.
Everywhere.
And there's no, how do you, and that's another problem with distribution, as we saw that in COVID, when the problem with getting meat to stores was we have narrowed down the channel through which it travels. So if one plant has a problem now, instead of having 1,000 plants spread out all over the place and you're close to your food, if COVID wouldn't have had hardly any effect on food distribution, if that was the case, almost none. But one thing happens to one factory where they kill 6,000 animals a day. Just do the math on how many animals that is in a month. If you're down for 2 weeks in that one plant, you think that's going to affect a lot of people? Absolutely, because you just, you know, that's 36,000 animals or something like that that just didn't go out right then. So it comes back to exactly what you said, I think, is that the problem is, the solution is the problem. Their solution is the problem. And what they're thinking is, well, I don't have to guess at what they're thinking. You can see what the process is here. Now, the next step for them is more control, because they have the bigger companies, the massive companies, to be able to make more money for their shareholders, because that's what they're doing. And I'm not saying profit is bad, and we'll get to that in just a second, I guess. But remind me to talk about why it's beneficial for ranchers to have more profit. We'll talk about that. But to have more profit in these big companies, there's only one way for them to do it now, and that's to push down on the bottom. What I mean by that is, packers are the ones who buy from a feedlot, sell to the retailers. Retailers are now, they used to be all kinds of different chains. Now they're pretty much just a few chains. The retailers are Walmart, Albertson, Kroger's, those kind of companies that sell the meat to retail customers. They have so much power now, the retailers have so much power, that the packers really can't raise the price to the retailer. So the retailers have enough oomph now. They can say, we're only going to pay you this much to the packer. So the Packers' only way to make more profit is to pay less to the feedlot, which means the feedlot can't afford to pay more to the rancher, so they have to pay less to the rancher. Now, we have less cattle in the United States right now than we did since 1948. So we're seeing a price increase. And whether it's created by market manipulation, I don't know. I would say it's more of a cause of the price being high for cattle right now, I think is more just an effect of that lack of cattle. But they're going to use that as a way to push, to put all the little guys out of business again, so where they don't have any competition. And then because they, right now, they don't have to put a label on it that says where it's born and raised. In fact, they can put a label on it that says it's the meat in the store is from the US, even when it's not at the moment. All they have to do is ship it in from Brazil, take it out of its package, put it in a new package, and put US on it. So when you look in the store and say US meat, that does not mean anything about where that came from. So they can just increase imports to drop that price, like you were saying. And even now, obviously they're doing that somewhat, because when you go to the store and hamburger is $3.48 a pound, there is nobody in the United States that can actually raise beef and sell it for $3.48 a pound for burgers.
Not even close. Not even
break even. Break even is about $5.
Yep.
For a US rancher. So that something's going on there. According to the USDA, over the last 23 years, feedlots have made a negative $24 a head. So they're not making the money. They're getting squished down at the top. We've had 85,000 feedlots go out of business in the last several years. Over 107,000 ranchers have gone out of business. So that's where the price has to go down for these big guys to make more profit. They can be more profitable if they pay less for the cattle. So to do that, they need to control everything. And they have to actually now come up with climate plans to appease the ESG or whatever it is that they're doing. So now they want to know now how to manipulate all these things like climate credits for taxes. You know what those are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
you want to break that down for those that don't know what it is?
Yeah. So the climate credits, now corporations, instead of actually changing what they do in their companies to meet their emissions goals that somebody at WEF, which is a group of billionaires that get together and decide what companies have to abide by. They're not even associated with a government. They're just a group of billionaires that get together and decide this is what companies should have to abide by. So they set emissions goals, and these companies have to hit those. Well, if they can't, or if they don't want to, what they have to do then, they've created a way now in the US where they just buy a credit from a rancher.
Offsets. Yep.
So they can buy, which explains a lot of why Bill Gates is buying massive amounts of farm ground, because he then can make money by selling the credits or using them himself and whatever he's doing, and can say, look at this, I'm net negative. Well, he's not really. He's buying air, or I don't even know what you call it. He's buying fake air from a rancher, because they say ranchers are actually producing carbon neutral or carbon negative credits, whatever that is. And then they sell them to these companies so that they can have a good name. And so that's one of the things they're having to do. So to do that, they need to know where all the cattle are. They need to control more of the rancher. So one of the ways they're doing that, and that's why I'm so against the RFID tags. So a lot of confusion about the RFID tags are electronic tags that are put on a cow or a calf. Right now, it was just put, how was it put in? Do you know, it was, who put it in there? USDA put it in there?
Yes.
And was it in the farm bill? Because it just got passed. So it's supposed to be implemented in 6 weeks. They tried to get it so every rancher in the United States, anybody who raises cattle, as soon as they're born, they have to tag them with this RFID computer chip in their ear, and then register it with the government. So the government can track, well, the USDA can track. And that's a tool that the big corporations, the Packers, want, because then they could even manipulate the movements of cattle even more to help their credit rating, or their carbon credit rating is what I'm talking about. So they have to know where all these movements are. Well, they couldn't get that quite passed. So they just passed the one where you have to have it now to cross state lines. I'm not making this up. I talk to ranchers all the time that have no idea that this was passed. So anybody who moves cattle across state lines now has to have a computer chip in their ear that the government tracks. This has already happened in Europe. So England already does this. And they're like, well, you know, it's just a cost of whatever. No, it's not a cost. It's not. It's about control. We already have brands. We already have ear tags. We already have systems to track all these things. We have brand inspectors that have to inspect those cattle and say, yes, these are the cattle that are supposed to cross. We already have all that stuff. We do not need a database so they can see where every rancher has cows and where they're moving them. Because when that happens, then these companies can say, well, you know, for climate, this area has too many cattle. It doesn't matter. There's no science. There wouldn't be any science behind that. It'd be like, I think there's too many cattle in this area, or we need to have a carbon loss in this area to save our bacon as a corporation. So we're just going to tell half the ranchers in that area they have to sell their cattle. That's, mm-hmm. I mean, that'd be the next step.
And what's really sad about all these hypotheses, all of this Malthusian economics, is there's no track record. And the track record we do have is when we hear these other apocalyptic predictions, like when the world was going to freeze over, and then that didn't happen. And then the polar ice caps were going to melt, and Al Gore flew around in his private jet and bought these carbon offsets so that he could do it. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? It really shows you that these technocratic fixers that are these alarmists that are creating the solutions are really just aggrandizing themselves and stuff in their own pockets. That's really what it comes down. It's just a different type of tax to redistribute wealth. And it really is coming. What it's coming down to is the top 1% is extracting 99% of the wealth from everybody else.
Exactly. And now they have, before we get on to the rancher's profit thing, on top of all this, they're now giving nature rights. So the Biden administration has just initialized a final rule on public land, BLM. And I wasn't sure exactly how this thing was going to work, but what they did is they created a new way to lease public ground. So right now you can lease public ground for grazing. So when you say ranchers have cattle on public land, yes, and they pay for that lease. Those are leases that they pay for. I would even argue that without that, that land would suffer massively from ecological damage. And we need those leases on there. The other leases are for oil and gas and you know, mines. Now they have to go through a massive process to get those leases on public land, but those are the other types of leases. Now they've added another one, which is conservation. So now these humongous companies, I didn't understand this at first, but this is what I believe is going on here. These massive companies now can purchase these conservation, I'm making quotation marks, leases on public ground for the purpose of restoration from degradation. That's the wording of it. But there is no indication who specifies what degradation is, who specifies what restoration means. Does that mean you eliminate the cattle? Because in my mind now, you've given nature rights. And when you do that, instead of like utilizing it to the best of your ability for the production for humans and wildlife and everything around it, you're now taking what someone believes may be better for that particular thing. So that's the beginning of not being able to utilize public ground for food production.
And what's more fascinating about that is the Club of Rome in 1970 wrote a paper on how they were going to do it. In that letter, by the Club of Rome, it talks about it doesn't name the WEF because it didn't have a name at the time, but it talks about the formation of the WEF, which was formed by that publication from the Club of Rome. And it explains this entire process of control, creating this crisis, making it around the environment, because it's something that unifies, and it's something that, because it happens over a long period of time, we can scare the crap out of everybody and tell them that the world is going to end. And it's because of this Malthusian concept that once there's so many people on the planet, it's over, you know, and this way we can control the population, we can control the animals, we can reabsorb all the land, you know, we can just take all the stuff back. And the most troubling thing about all of it is there are the guys that are actively demonstrating the solutions now, and they're showing the carbon sequestration, and they're showing the food production, they're showing the high quality that flies in the face of all this technocratic scientism. So people always want to point to this stuff and this data, and I'm like, hey, what about these lunatic farmers that are demonstratingly proving you wrong with the data and providing for themselves and for thousands of other people? And we don't have to just like let this land go dormant and desolate so that everything around us looks like Mad Max.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about now some solutions to this, because for a long time there, I was thinking the only way to get around this is to, well, which probably should happen anyway, is they need to enforce the acts. Instead of worrying so much about efficiency in the climate, they need to enforce monopoly controls over our food so that we don't have four companies controlling our entire food system. That would be very helpful. Then there would actually have to be competition. The prices would be reset some. So the commodity markets for cattle would meat would change. But if you want to do something right now, and I think an answer to the problem is not worry about that at all. One of the answers is allow that system to do what it's doing and set up new systems, which is buying directly from ranchers and then people creating marketplaces. And here's the issue with this is you have to have people who, as I talked before, have the mindset that even though it's more expensive, they're going to create a value system for their customer, which sets them apart. If you want to make more money at this, then create a value to your customers that they are helping the environment and their local communities by purchasing locally and selling locally. So marketplaces that are physical, like Calcrate set up, where he's got, you know, where he built a distribution point. And if I was going to start somewhere, I would start retail. I mean, starting a packing plant is great, but you have to have a way to sell your beef. If you're not selling beef, packing plant is irrelevant in my mind.
And y'all, I'm going to do a shameless plug, because we are trying to do exactly what Trinity's talking about. And we use a very small local microprocessor, and this is what we're trying to do. So if you are looking for beef and you're in the Northeast Texas area, it will be for local pickup. Go on over to thetexasboys.com and sign up for our newsletter. We should be having another cow available soon. And this is what we are trying to do. And it's not enough to just talk about the problems. We have to be the solution. And in reality, exactly what Trinity is saying, right? He's saying, demonstrate this value. All these transnational mega corporations with their green little icons that they splash on everything and how they're solar powered and all this stuff, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
We're going to do it for real and keep our money here.
Mm-hmm. And I'm starting right now a community called Life in the West, where, because what I found as a problem is people aren't able to locate. A lot of ranchers aren't going to ship. Shipping meat is tricky because you have to have a styrofoam box, and you have to have, you know, you dry ice, and it's very expensive to ship meat. So knowing where these communities are, I'm in, are the places that you can get local meat. I'm going to starting a community where inside that community, you can actually ask people where to go for meat in whatever area you're in. So we'll try to set up places where, like your area, people can put in, I sell this much meat here, there, you know, these are my pickup times, all that kind of stuff. Because I tried it on Facebook, but it's so hard because you're not reaching everybody. If you can't really search what you're trying to get. So I'm going to have to do it elsewhere. But anyway, that kind of thing brings, so the profit now that's going directly to the packers and the retailers. This has been my question in my mind. If that profit were to go to the ranchers, what would change? I got to be honest. All ranchers are not good. They're not even nice. You know, I'm not saying ranchers are the nicest people, and they don't. Some of them are. I'm sorry. Some of them are entitled. They've inherited a ranch, fourth generation, and they're like nobody else should be able to do this but me. Yeah. You know, and that's wrong. But they still grow food for you guys, and if you give them more profit. If you give them profit, even though, wow, everybody's like offended that I would talk about profit for ranchers because they, you know, they're having this on the land, but you give them more profit. Here's the answer to what that does for people. Because I've talked to now many ranchers who understand this a little bit, who have started in the business in the last 15 years, 20 years. Okay. And they have created, because they had money when they came in, they were able to innovate in or test things. So they're like, you know what? What if we graze this pasture differently? What if we add this water tank over here instead of over there? Would it degrade less? Would it create more pasture land? Would it help the wildlife? I talked to a rancher that like, what if we, you know, this stream has this native cutthroat in it and it's completely isolated from everywhere else. What if we talk to the fish and game and, you know, because they're looking for these native cutthroat, what if they can utilize this somehow for, you know, repopulating? So those types of things only happen in ranching situations where they have profit. If you don't have profit, you have zero room to test. You can't change anything. You can't try anything. If it fails once, you're dead. You're done. You're already living. Most ranchers have a line of credit that they operate off for the year. That's a loan. And then these loans are usually from $250,000 to $1 million a year. They take out that loan, they're paying the loan back, and the rest, whatever they make on top of it, is profit for that year. Well, now the interest rate doubled on that, by the way, but doubled 4.8% to 10% on those farm loans. So that's going to hurt. So even though they make more money on their calves, they're spending most of that profit right back into interest.
Yeah.
But the ones who innovate and change things and decide, you know, let's try to sell cattle directly to customers. Well, that takes some time. You have to change how you operate. You can't just run calves until they're 6 months old and sell them all. You have to save some back. You have to figure out how to feed them for another year. Then you have to figure out how to butcher them and get them to the, you know, and that takes money and time. And if you're running on a shoestring anyway, you can't do it. So
yeah,
more profit to these guys helps them think of new ways to run most ranchers. Okay. I'm not the ones that aren't going to change. Aren't going to change. You're going to have that in any industry, but as a whole, I honestly believe more profit to these ranchers will help them produce better on the land they have, which means better habitat for wildlife, which means better meat to you, which means better grass on the ecosystem, which means better fish in the streams, which means cleaner water, which means, I mean, it leads to everything. Whereas funneling all the profit to these four big companies or to Walmart doesn't do a dang thing for that.
Yeah.
Because they can just buy a credit off the ranch, which doesn't do anything.
Right. The other thing about larger profit margin and cutting out this monolithic system is by creating that larger profit margin, if you are an aspiring rancher and a startup with a larger profit margin there, one, you're going to become profitable faster and you're going to be willing to take the risk.
Yes.
And that is,
there's a lot of risk.
Yep. That's critically important because
absolutely
everybody can say whatever, but with the loss of the number of cows and the number of ranchers, these technocratic, monolithic, transnational corporations, they're still not going to be able to make up the gap. And this is the opportunity that's available. And as people become educated and wake up and then are willing to put their money where their mouth is and willing to recognize the value and then invest in their own community, like don't ask for a government grant. Invest in your own community. Invest in whoever that person is in your neighborhood, in your community that's trying, and then build upon that. And it'll literally build a culture that we were an agrarian culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, post-Depression era, everybody had a garden. Everybody had a dairy cow. And it was a very different world. And people were very connected to their food. And they understood that an animal had to die. Yeah. So they raised it in an ethical way. And they appreciated the sacrifice that that animal made to feed their family. And there wasn't this synthetic, gigantic disconnect. That disconnect psychologically damages your brain, where not only are you disconnected from your food, the disconnected from the concept that animals die. If you're a vegan, vegetarian or whatever, like, animals die to keep your lettuce alive. Okay. Whether it's pesticides, whether it's all the NPK, whether it's they have to sniper the deers because it's eating the lettuce, animals are dying. All the animals are dying in the cultivation process when they're tilling the soil and killing the gophers and all this stuff. And if you're that deluded that you think you can eat a green plant and millions of animals don't die so you can eat that plant, your brain is broken.
Yeah. And not only that, but that land is not being used for cattle. So, or anything grazing. So you're actually losing, you're limiting habitat for animals at the same time. And, and so let's talk about that though, that the health thing, because what is the benefit to humans that we eat more meat? Right. And that's the thing, is we've lost this. We, for some reason, people have this in their mind. I run into it all the time. Well, you can't eat fat and you can't eat meat. Those are too many of those things and it's bad. So you have been on the carnivore diet for how long now?
340 days, something like that.
Yes. And you know, you were talking to Anthony Chafee, and this is one of the things that I talked to him about was, you know, back, 150 years ago when there was just hunter gatherers on the land, they lived almost entirely off of meat. So this idea that we can't live off of meat and that it's not healthy for us is literally insane. It's unscientific, for one thing. I don't know where in the world they're getting this. And then the fact that they think they can replicate nature or replace meat with plant impossible meat crud that is literally formed in a lab somewhere that they try to understand and feed it to your cells. I'm not joking here. That's a company called Ginkgo that does that. Tries to create amino acids and things that actually interact with your cells in different ways. And they sell these ingredients to companies like Impossible Meat because they're trying to replicate the flavors and of meat. Well, that doesn't sound dangerous at all, because that's the same company that's actually manufacturing RNA vaccines. So, or doing some of the research behind them. They're not manufacturing them, but that's to think that meat is not good. I mean, so what is your, after eating just meat for, you know, over 300 days, how do you feel comparatively? What are the differences?
It's revolutionary. We were very organic, kind of crunchy people. We were gluten-free. At one point in time, we had an A2 dairy cow, But then through this health journey and trying to figure everything out, we eliminated dairy. So we eliminated all this stuff and it left us mostly with whole foods, kind of plant-based. But yet for some reason, I still couldn't sleep. I didn't feel good. And then come to find out I had a degenerative shoulder disease that ate my labrum. So now I needed a shoulder replacement. So, hey, why don't we try this carnivore thing? And 340 days later, I sleep like a baby. The one thing I was hoping is I would stop snoring. I still snore. I sleep like a baby. I feel great. I'm lean and mean. I can't exercise like I used to because of my shoulder. I'm still rehabilitating that. I got it scoped and a bicep tendinesis, so I'm still kind of recovering from that. But overall, wellness, sleep, feel better, look younger, I'm thinner. I was never fat or overweight, but I was still carrying around maybe 13 pounds of just excess weight. That's all gone. 340 days, only meat. I have no problems using the bathroom. I don't crave kale or green beans or lima beans. You don't need to eat vegetables. I do have 400 fruit trees. I still eat fruit when it's in season. But I can attest to the fact that 340 days of eating only meat, and I eat an enormous amount of eggs. I feel better. My body is functioning better. My shoulder is continuing to heal and improve. And
so, what do you eat mostly then? Do you eat like hamburger? Do you eat steak? Or do you roast or egg? What kind of stuff do you eat in a day? What's a normal meal day?
Okay, a normal meal day for me is I wake up, I drink a glass of water, I do all my stuff, I go to work, I come home around 4 o'clock, and I usually eat one meal a day, so I plan on eating at 5. So at around 4:30, I drink what I call my carnivore coffee. That consists of 15 egg yolks and some coffee in a 32-ounce jar like that. And I use an immersion blender and I whip it, and it's just like having heavy cream in it. So I drink that.
All right. How many egg yolks is this?
15.
15 and just the yolks?
Just the yolks. Yep. I separate the egg whites.
With coffee?
Yep. With coffee.
Just so black and coffee, egg yolks, yep, whipped together. Is that pretty thick?
It's incredible. And it's not thick. It's just like if you put heavy cream in your coffee.
Really?
Yeah. It's incredible. The egg yolk with the immersion blender, you're welcome. I just changed your coffee world.
Okay. So do you guys have chickens then too? Or?
Yes, we have lots of chickens.
Yes, because that's a lot of eggs. So then, okay, that's you have the coffee, then what?
I have the coffee. Then we just got a cow back, so we do have a full selection of steaks. So I'll either eat a prime rib or a ribeye or a like a sirloin, and I stick the temperature probe in it. I put it in the air fryer. I set it for 115 and 20 minutes. Halfway through, I flip it over. About 20 minutes, the steak comes out perfect. One thing that has happened to me on the carnivore diet is I continue to, it's going to sound real skeevy to some people. I continue to eat my meat rarer and rarer.
Really?
It tastes better and better. So now when I make a hamburger, I mean, I brown the outside, but I want that internal temperature to be right. But I want it cooked as least amount as possible. And I really like the medium rare to rare steak. And I've been doing that for 300 days.
So what do you put on your hamburger? Do you just eat hamburger just regular with nothing on it, or do you put some lettuce on there? What do you do?
I usually, maybe if I have it, I put some type of cheese on there, like maybe either a Colby Jack or a Swiss.
Okay.
Other than that, I just put some Redmond's Real Salt on it.
Some what?
Redmond's Real Salt.
Redmond's Real Salt. So yeah. Then what's the deal with eating once a day? Is that something you did before? Is that because of the carnivore thing or what?
It's a little bit, it's just the intermittent fasting concept where you're restraining your caloric intake for a longer period of time to create ketogenesis, where this, you know, in this ketogenesis phase, your body can repair and cells can regenerate. So that's what they found from fasting. And by creating that longer time frame from between, say I'm done eating at 6 o'clock. So really between 6 and 4, my body is in a fasting state. And then when I do eat, since I'm not eating carbohydrates, technically that ketosis state continues. But the reason that I have that small eating window is to just, it improves mental clarity. One of the biggest things that I noticed with carnivore, and I was completely unaware that I had brain fog, and I had this like, oh, I can't, what's that word? And who's his name? And what's that guy? And within 2 weeks of carnivore, relatively speaking, that went away. Brain fog. I didn't even know I had brain fog. And I'm like, oh, that's what brain fog is.
Right. Right. Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a real thing. Yeah. So what about the, so you're eating, if you're eating meat and then egg yolks, what about your cholesterol and all that stuff?
I've done my blood work twice and it's spot on.
Really?
My blood work's great. I've never been a believer in cholesterol. You know, we know from Atkins that he kind of debunked that whole cholesterol thing, and they keep lowering that number so that we're all on statins.
Yeah.
Statins, and somebody just awful. Asked me, you want to hear something crazy? Somebody just asked in the chat, Carnivore Coder, he asked me about sunburn, and I've never been an easy sunburner, but we have a farm. I have a lot of trees. I do, grafting, and I'm outside a lot, and I'm in Texas, very intense sun. And every year I would eventually sunburn just from extended exposure. I mean, I'll be in the sun 12 hours a day, like days in a row, and I would absolutely sunburn. I do not sunburn, and I can't explain it. I do not sunburn.
Wow.
It won't happen, and I can't explain it, but carnivores do not sunburn.
That is interesting.
Yeah, so, it's very interesting.
I really apologize that my camera did not work. I haven't done a lot of these lives in a while, and so I'm going to have to figure out how to hook my phone up. I see I got a blurry image here.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
That's you. As far as I got. So you want to
thought you were hiding, Trinity. You were trying to hide your true identity.
I am not trying to hide, man. I've been, while we're talking, I've been trying to figure this out, but that's as far as I got. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to just focus on talking and forget that.
Yep. So, yeah, it's been great. Thanks, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, interesting. Very interesting. You probably have to go, but I was just going to talk about this for just a second. That
sure.
We're talking about all these different things. So we have these ideas that are brought to us to sell certain things. So the corporations need to make money. So to make money, they sell to the government this idea that we need to bring prices down for consumers. And then we have an ideology, which I believe, of climate change, which I believe is mostly not about the client. It's about people making money. And I know there's some that believe in it truly, you know, but I don't think it's a massive thing. Like everybody thinks the climate's going to die. I think it's a money-making deal. It's like the wolves. I think that, and timber, I think those are money-making schemes too. It's just like, mm-hmm. you know, how can we make money with donations and then sue mm-hmm. the government, and the government has to pay us, you know, it's a money-making deal. If you take the money away, most of that's gone. And so all these things, and what we're talking about today is the alternatives of them. And the reason you don't hear about the alternatives as much is because not money behind them. Ranchers right. don't flock together. Number one, I was just talking about this yesterday. I was sitting with a friend of mine who's a rancher, okay, at a track meet watching my daughter. And him and his wife were saying, yeah, so they were at the track meet too to watch their son. But to do that, they had had to stay up till 11:30 the night before, loading a load of hay so they could go up at 5 in the next morning and go feed it to make it to the track meet for 4 hours, and then leave there and go check the cows, do another feeding, change the water, and then go to their son's, you know, recital at the school. And it's like, these people work harder than anybody I know of. Now, not all ranchers do. Some sure. don't. I don't think they do a great job. Okay. But the ones that really do, they work hard. They do not have time, nor do they have the will to go fight something in Washington yeah. with a group. If they did, they would lose. Every day they lose is a massive amount of profit somewhere, you know, so that they're focused on that. Whereas corporations have a lot of money to spend on lobbying or basically advertising for what they want to happen to make more profit for them. So you have to understand what you're hearing. It's gone into the universities teach this stuff now. You know, I was at a university that was, you know, Meatless Monday yeah. on Earth Day. And I'm like,
Nicole's.
You're promoting this. That's a simple thing that teaches students save the planet, go meatless. That's it doesn't say that, yeah. but if you're saying Meatless Monday is on Earth Day, what you're telling them psychologically. So this is a training thing that we're fighting throughout this entire, it's all advertising and for this goal of make the corp, keep the corporations big so they can have big profits, and that'll save the planet. And in fact, what we're talking about today is the opposite. You can be healthy eating meat. Eating yep. meat is a great thing, especially if you're eating it directly from a ranch that doesn't have all the antibiotics and crap that goes through the system and the climate that we can adjust our, especially if we adjust how we use cattle, you can improve the climate by enormous amounts. Maybe not the climate, the ecosystems. I have no idea. The climate thing is up in the air because I don't believe the CO2 is actually the issue. I think it's a following right. cause, but that's neither here nor there. So all of these things can be different, but we don't hear about them unless we talk about them, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. And this has been awesome, man. And I want to do this again.
Absolutely. I'll try to get my camera working and then we'll do it again.
Yeah, this has been great. I appreciate you taking the time. I definitely appreciate the information. I appreciate everything you're doing. Your message, in my opinion, is spot on. And we need, just like you were saying, if we're going to invest our time and take our time, and if we could just help educate people, wake them up, they're going to mm-hmm. see the value and they're going to invest in that value. And this is going to create this parallel economy and this parallel system, which is going to create opportunities for aspiring ranchers. And this movement, in lack of a better term, should grow itself, so to speak. And that's why I love your message. I love what you're doing. That's why we're trying to do what we're doing here and get the message out and speak the truth and share. And then we want to demonstrate it. You know, that's why we do mm-hmm. our carnivore update things. And that's why we do all the different things we do. We used to be more of like a lifestyle channel showing our homesteading, but we're so busy now, right? We just can't, we don't have the editing time to do right. the really cool videos.
And the editing is a massive undertaking as far as time goes. Absolutely.
And yep. people that watch YouTube have zero appreciation for how long it takes to make a thumbnail, how long it takes to edit a 15-minute video.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're doing it right, it's an hour a minute. So
yeah.
nobody, homie don't got time for that.
No, so, that's a lot of work.
This is what we're doing.
Yeah.
And man, for any of y'all that aren't subscribed to Trinity's channel, one, the message is spot on. The quality is excellent. It's very friendly, which I completely and totally, I can't say enough about that, because there's so much stuff that isn't
right. And, right.
The message is real. Your kids can watch it. So this is, hey man, Meatless Monday, right? At the elementary school.
Yeah.
These poor kids are getting brainwashed from jump.
Right. Oh, yeah.
So if you're producing material that like, hey, don't listen to that foul mouth fool, like turn right. that thing off. Right. How are we going to re-educate these poor brainwashed kids? Yeah. Right. So that's why I do everything I can, even if I have a guest on, like, so if I'm concerned about the way a guest may speak, hey man, I'm not your moral, whatever. I'm not going to prohibit your speech. I will edit you. will edit you before I post you, you know?
Right. So,
it's neat when I have somebody that I can say, hey man, you want to do a live stream? Because I can't do that with
everybody. Right. Right. Exactly.
So man, I just can't reiterate how much I appreciate what you're doing. We are going, maybe we could do this like on a monthly basis or something, but
it'd be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Your message and your community and what you're trying to do in Foster is exactly what we're trying to do. And it is our message. And I can't promote you enough in what you're doing. Check out Trinity Vandenacre on YouTube. Where Trinity, where can everybody else find you? Are you on any other platforms?
Yeah, I'm on TikTok and Instagram, Facebook. My page got hacked and is deleted, but I created a new one. So it's got almost nobody, 285,000 followers gone on. So now I got to rebuild that. So it's called Life in the West on Facebook, or you can find my profile on there. Yeah, so I'm on all of those.
Well, this has been excellent. Thanks so much for your time. Remember, y'all, this is a value for value proposition. If you enjoy our content or our guests, one, go support them. Two, go to thetexasboys.com. Check us out. Maybe you need what we got. Maybe you're local and you're looking for some beef or pork. Join our newsletter. And remember, y'all, stay fearless, my friends.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Trinity. Appreciate you, man.
Absolutely.